Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we're back. Another edition of the Toy Department. Derek Madden, Matt Kolsky. You don't mind I say your name for you, do you?
No, I love that you say my name for me.
We're back, and we've done homework this time. It's good, right?
Yeah, like professionals or something. What's going on?
It's weird. It does feel weird to actually say we're going to do something and then actually do it.
Yeah, delivering, following through. It's a new experience for me, generally speaking, but I'm not going to say I hate it.
All right, so should we start with one of the things that we talked about last week was the Showtime show, The Circus, which is about the presidential election. I kind of compared it to if you ever watch one of those like HBO 24/7s or Hard Knocks, you know what I mean? It's like that for the presidential campaign would be the analogy that I use. Did you have a similar experience when you watched it?
I think that's a pretty good description of what it is. I would not say my experience watching this show is like my experience watching Hard Knocks, and I can very easily crystallize for you why that is. The result of me watching this show was much what I expected it to be, which is a mix of horror and disgust, and also just of sad, deep sadness. And I think it probably illustrates why I want to do a podcast called The Toy Department.
I think that's fair. Just a
little background on me. The last time I was really politically engaged, I was going door to door as a volunteer for John Kerry's campaign, and it broke me.
That's pretty engaged. You know
I was a very political youth.
I have
strong beliefs in things, and that's why I was a political youth. But not long after that election, I decided for my own mental health and just to not live a life of fury.
So you dropped off the map politically completely, essentially, right? You just...
In terms of American politics and the political process, yeah, I have.
Do you vote?
Yeah, I vote for presidential elections.
And that's it. That's the limit, though.
That's more or less it, and that's really out of a sense of responsibility. It's like the eat your whole dinner because children in Africa are starving sort of a thing.
I
do have love and respect for the philosophy of the American legal process. Here's the problem. And this show illustrated it perfectly. The American political process is not about politics. It's not about policy. It's not about trying to improve anything. It's about winning. And Donald Trump is proving right now that the only thing you have to care about to be a factor in an American presidential election, the only thing you have to care about is winning. Because that's his only politic. He has no... And, you know, I don't want to go too far down the non-toy department road, but watching this show, you truly see the artifice of Donald Trump and what he's doing, and it horrifies
There's a scene in this show where they're, you know, at a Trump campaign event, and he's opening up a hotel, right? I think that's kind of – I'm guessing this is sort of what kind of set you off.
Yeah, well, that was the major stroke. Sure.
Right, so he's opening up a hotel, and just for people who haven't seen it, and he's taking a few questions, and of course they're all about foreign affairs and substantive policy things, and he's sort of giving non-substantive answers, and then he pivots to, "Wow, I got to show you the hotel." That, like, it's pretty obvious that no one in the press corps actually wants to see, but he kind of just the moment he's in a, you know, in a jam, he sort of just goes back on the celebrity charm offensive.
Yeah, and they even, you know, actually what really probably set me off more was the fact that he gave a speech to basically the Israel lobby that was rated well. You know, I mean, the pundits were like, oh, he did a good job there.
Right, and that part was of supposed this... to be like the serious, tough speech that right. he was going to have to give among, you know, with a demanding group of people.
Exactly. This is the one where he'll really have to get into his policies. And he didn't. He did the same. He did the same garbage. He spouted off nonsensical rhetoric.
Right.
And he made promises with no illustration of his actual thought process. And then here's the best part. The next scene after that is the Brussels attacks.
Right.
And all right. Literally, just for one second, this is probably, there's so many things that set me off, but he sits down to do a TV interview with Bloomberg, and off camera, off interview, the first thing he says, you hear it on the TV show, the first thing he says is, man, I got such good marks for my speech yesterday, and no one got to hear it because of the Brussels attacks.
Yeah.
And it's like, really? It's a shame all those people were murdered because no one got to hear about your great speech. Goodness gracious.
I'm going to do my best to drag kicking and screaming back into the toy department.
I'm sorry. The show is great. You know, I think what this tells you is that the show is incredibly well made and entertaining.
Yes.
I just shouldn't watch it.
I don't disagree with anything that you've said. And I do think, and I'm, you know, from a molecular level, and I people talk a lot about the reasons for why Trump is where he is in this race. Personally, and without getting into the definite non-department, toy department, socio-political stuff about his success, what's made Trump successful in this race is that he figured out that it's the coverage of presidential campaigns in general is mostly about the horse race and who's winning, and that these things are won and lost on television. And essentially what he is in this race is he's just a TV talking head political pundit, right? He spouts his opinions off the top of his head. They may mean something in the moment, and they may mean something later, or they may not. He may just take them, walk them back, and it all plays really well on television. And so that's, you know, I think that's kind of where Trump is right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's true about Trump. I would sort of diminish that analogy for his purposes to say that he's like a really irresponsible, poorly foundation. I don't know how to describe this. A political pundit who is not that smart and has a poor philosophical foundation.
Well, but that's just a political pundit, from what I can tell.
Well, worst of political punditry, and now it's and but you're right. It's all he has realized something that I'm going to make a sports analogy now. We talk about the way the Seahawks play defense or the way Chris Paul tries to defend Steph Curry in the NBA. You just start pushing and shoving from the moment the game begins, and you put referees in a tough position because they have to decide, do I call fouls constantly or do I just let some of this stuff go? And that's kind of what Donald Trump is doing to this election. Well, I'm going to say all this ridiculous stuff, but it's not really going to matter because no one's going to pay attention to my overall record. They're just going to react in the moment to whether I pwned somebody.
Right. Well, and he's the Warriors in the sense that he saw the game changing before other people did and got there first.
Yeah, except that, you know, there's no – the difference between politics and a game, obviously, is it's not a goddamn game, Donald
Trump. Well, yes, I understand that. And I really am trying to discuss this as apolitically as
sorry,
I can.
Sorry, and you're doing a good job, and so, I keep dragging you back into it. That's my
But my point about the show, and I think you got this as well, is that because, look, these campaigns are now almost completely waged on television, the circus gives you a window, and it's a window, because it's not like you're seeing these people completely in casual moments. They're definitely still aware that they are on television.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a big part of the access. But some of that guard is let down, I think, in a way that you don't see. And they're often recording these sort of basic human interactions, maybe from a distance, where you're seeing a candidate interact with an individual citizen in a way that is, well, not real, you know, different. And it's almost like, you know, in a way where those people, they are aware that there are cameras around and they're behaving somewhat accordingly. But there's also something that's a little different than the script that we're normally fed. And I find it to be a really fascinating look. And to me, it's a really quick 20, 25 minutes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it reminds me actually of a really good political documentary called Spin that was made in 1995 that I believe actually a high school teacher showed to me and a class of students. That was about the Clinton-Dole election, I believe. And, you know, just these things where you see these incredible moments in the background of off camera at a news show, you know, Bob Dole and Larry King talking about old man prescription medications. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, that's the same philosophy of this show, that we try to take you behind some of the spin, but I think it is less and less possible in today's media culture.
Yeah, that's like those looks are more and more rare, which is, again, I guess why I'd recommend it. Yeah. All right, so I want to jump real quick to Tao and the Get Down Stay Downs.
Yeah.
Which I enjoyed listening to. And I'm going to just kind of pivot away from talking about what actually is on the record.
Okay.
Because I had this feeling while listening to it of like, hey, indie rock. You know, I remember when I listened to a lot of indie rock and people kind of making these off kilter avant-garde noises was uh-huh. really exciting and fun. And it's not that I don't still enjoy that, because clearly I did. I enjoyed listening to it. I couldn't help this feeling listening to the record of, and maybe this is just me doing my job as a music industry person, but I couldn't help feeling like how inconsequential it felt. Like, it was hard for me because I'm listening to this and I'm like, this is good, but it's not going to reach people or excite people. It's just going to be a thing in a little box. And I started thinking about, Sirius XMU has a show now that's like a mid-2000s indie rock nostalgia show. Okay. And I was thinking a lot about that moment in indie music where...
What would you, just to couch it, what would you put as like a couple of reference songs for that station in your mind?
Okay, so, when we turned it on, they were playing the band Wolf Parade.
Okay, yeah, love Wolf Parade. Yeah. I have a feeling this is going to be right in my wheelhouse.
By the way, making a comeback.
Yeah, I heard that.
They're back together doing some stuff, which is cool.
Yeah.
And touring again and whatnot.
Yeah.
There was a whole time where you had, you know, the Arcade Fire and the Postal Service and these, you know, indie bands coming over from England, like your Block Parties.
Franz Ferdinand.
Franz Ferdinand, yeah. There was a whole scene in Canada that, you know, went beyond the Arcade Fire into bands like Broken Social Scene and Wolf Parade. And, some of these bands were really getting, like, big looks at radio. And some of them even had a few, like, hit songs and sold a lot of records and, you know... The Arcade Fire can still play arenas, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I just don't know, like, who were the, you know, like that, the mid-2000s was a time when Pitchfork, the website Pitchfork, right, could write a huge review, you know, what they thought about a band was really important. It could help make or break a band, you know? Nowadays, it's like the big Pitchfork reviews are when they reviewed the new Zayn from One Direction or, you know, what's their take on Kanye. Like, I don't feel like Pitchfork makes stars anymore. Like, who are the big indie rock stars? It's like Mac DeMarco or Grimes.
Yeah, I think like, Grimes is a great is a good choice. I mean,
either they're slanted like Grimes is in a really sort of I'm indie but I'm making pop music kind of direction, or they are just things that you know are not ever going to get out of their little cultural cul-de-sac. You know what I mean?
Is that
makes me sad.
Well, is that maybe just a function of sort of our media culture that there's a fine line between sort of mainstream-ish and niche? You know, that Grimes, who in many ways is a niche-y type of artist, gets just enough attention via social media and her sort of interaction with the media and the world. She gets just enough hits out of that to be more of a pop thing, but then just on the other side of that is Tao, who probably will never get those hits, but is making, you know, pretty interesting music that people who care about music will enjoy listening to.
Yeah, I just, you know, I've always been one of those people that believes that the culture is better when there are some interesting things in the larger conversation, some challenging things, some left of center things. And I feel like maybe right now, the only person that's doing that in like a large scale cultural conversation is Kanye, basically, the only guy that's like weird and challenging. I guess maybe you could say Kendrick. And I feel like we're sort of like...
No, I think definitely... I think Kendrick is more interestingly challenging than Kanye. You know?
I think, yeah, but I think we're lacking for those voices in the conversation because so much of the larger cultural conversation about music is now T-Swift and Katy Perry and...
is there even a cultural
conversation? And not to say that there's anything wrong with them. I mean, maybe I will say there's something wrong with them. But like... It's just whatever. That's just the they're just spoonfuls of sugar. You know what I mean? Which is not to denigrate spoonfuls of sugar. I just want other flavors in the mix. You know what I mean?
No, I mean I completely agree with you. I think, you know, I'm as into those flavors as anyone. But I just wonder if those flavors haven't found their level.
I guess there has to be more to talk about, like as a group than Beyonce. No shade on Beyonce. There just should be more.
Well, I think this gets to the core of the idea of a cultural conversation, which, you know, to have an interesting and legitimate cultural conversation, there has to be some level of broad appeal. And I think, unfortunately, like, it's hard for us meaning humans in the cultural world, it's hard for us to agree broadly on very much.
Sure.
You know, the things that we agree broadly on are the things like Beyonce and Kanye, who manage to make art and music that is widely people can appreciate it across a right. wide spectrum, and yet also they do certain things, small things usually, to be interesting outside of just the music. And that's sort of where the intersection of broad appeal and legitimate culture conversation is.
Right, and that's sort of what I'm saying is like that, you know, in at least in the 2000s, you know, you could be weird, you could be the Arcade Fire and have 10 people on stage and be banging each other with motorcycle helmets and still play, you know, 20,000 seat venues. You know,
I feel like it's somewhat cyclical, though. You
and,
know,
and, I mean, like, you know, it's like as we're having this conversation, you know, I'm thinking about more things from that time. You know, Vampire Weekend, the whole New
MGMT.
York scene with the and the Strokes and all that stuff was happening.
Then. Yep.
LCD Sound System, uh-huh. like all of this mid-2000s like music that, you know, still impacts people in a way today that these bands can now get together and, you know, headline summer festivals.
Is this just
10 years from now there's nothing indie that's going to be able to do that, right?
Or not, or it circles back around. I mean, or it's just a thing where these new interesting things happen and they sort of get appropriated into the culture, and the things like One Direction and Beyonce and Kanye incorporate them and swallow them into the broader appeal stuff, and then we have sort of another revolution of the left field, if you were, coming back strong. I mean, I think ideally that's what happens.
Yeah, you know, to me, and this is one of those things, this is, I'll go way deep music industry, you know, conversation here. You know, there are a lot of people in this business who I think believe that everything is cyclical. And, you know, when, you know, if you have a genre, whether it be, you know, the way people talk about rock, it's kind of in a down place right now. And there are people who just believe, oh, it's going to come back because that's what it's always done. It's receded and come back. I take the opposite belief in that I think that the machinery of the business, the pipeline of the business has changed dramatically and will continue to change dramatically roughly every 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah.
And I just don't know that we're set up now to get good music into the hands of a lot of people.
Well, what's the it should be easier, right? I mean, by all rights, it should be easier to get good music in the hands of more people. So what is it in your eyes that's the what about the mechanics have changed in a way that is sort of disruptive?
Well, it's easier to get your good music into the hands of some people, right? But now there is no place to reach, you know, there's like, you know, getting the kind of reach that you need to have a larger cultural conversation is more and more difficult. Cutting through noise is more and more difficult, right? You know, essentially, honestly, for something really left of center right now to really reach a lot of people, you need a good sync, basically. You need a good spot in a television commercial, or a really popular movie or television show or something like that, where a lot of people who might not stumble upon it otherwise are going to see it. And that's not really a great way forward. You know what I mean?
Well, but as time goes on, I think more and more people are receptive to more and more sources for that sort of thing.
I don't know that that's true. I think people are mostly receptive to their friends, or if they have people that are, you know, they sort of rely on the internet for music, but like it's a recommendation kind of economy now.
But why couldn't a band like an Arcade Fire develop the sort of following it has out of like sort of, you know, grassroots wildfire catching version of that?
Well, can you name a time in the last couple of years where you've seen that happen, where a band is via grassroots word of mouth? Been like that doesn't really exist. I guess the closest thing to me would be like 21 Pilots kind of did that, but really it wasn't until they got on the radio that combined with that sort of already grassroots word of mouth and touring that sort of took them to the place that they are now.
Well, but I mean, it couldn't at the risk of being a bit of a douche, if 21 Pilots was a more interesting band, couldn't the same thing have happened? I mean, theoretically. Well,
I guess you could say that theoretically, but then show me an example where that did happen. You know, like, well, people talk about the internet, and like, everyone's getting their new music from the internet. Show me, like, one f***ing thing the internet's broken. Like, show me a record that has reached kind of a mass audience, you know, just from the internet. The only thing that I can even sort of think of is Harlem Shake.
Yeah, that was a thing, but that's getting to be a bit in the past.
Sure is. And that's not like, it's not like we created an artist there. That was a song.
Moment. I mean, yeah, and right around that time was the, what's his face, too? Psy.
Yeah. And, you know, Turn Down for What? Like that kind of thing.
Yeah. But Turn like, Down for What? That's classic stuff.
But like, you know what I mean? Like it's kind of slim pickings in that realm.
Yeah. I can't help but think that it is as likely to be coincidence, you know, the fact that there just aren't great bands that often. It's not that easy to be a great band.
But I don't know that that's it. Like, you know, I think the quality of music over time is roughly the same. I think that 10% of things are really great, and 25% of things are really terrible.
But that doesn't
mean the rest is somewhere in the middle. I think that's always true.
It doesn't mean you couldn't go a little stretch without anything really great breaking, though.
Yeah, I suppose. I just think it's just hard. It's harder for things to reach people now.
Yeah.
All right, let's pivot, and you know, because we have a lot we want to do.
Yeah, here. just to put a quick bow on that, I think it's the most salient idea that you have there in my eyes is the idea of cutting through the noise. It's harder to cut through the noise.
Yeah.
And I think that's very real.
And there's a lot of noise.
There's a lot of damn noise.
All right, so speaking of noise, we lost a couple people last week. I know we're getting a little bit away from it now, but we didn't want to let this show pass without shouting out to Fife Dog and Gary Shandling.
I mean, Fife passed while we were recording, basically, last week. And, you know, I think this is a common story, but just for me, Tribe Called Quest was a huge part of me becoming, I mean, to put it in sort of simple real world terms, you would not have found me at the new parish jumping up and down and bumping into my neighbors at the Freddie Gibbs show last week if I had not had a Tribe Called Quest when I was 12 and 13.
Right.
Frankly,
and you would not have found me jumping up and down at the Freddie Gibbs show last week because I wasn't there.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, you know, I never get to Wu-Tang and the Freddie Gibbses of the world and Madlib and J Dilla and all the stuff that I love in hip-hop. You know, you need those gateways in your musical life.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. And I, you know, Tribe was a gateway for me too. In fact, I won't sit here. I'm not enough of a hip-hop authority even to say like, oh, this is the best old school album. But I can definitively say that Low End Theory is my favorite old school hip hop album.
It's incredible. I mean, Low End Theory and Midnight Marauders are both probably perfect hip hop albums, in their own way. Beats, Rhymes, and Life was huge for me just on timing. When it came out, I was sort of a wide open musical receptacle, if you will, and that sort of opened the door for me. And then I went back to those albums. But I mean, the cleverness, the creativeness with the way they used music in their beats, the cleverness of the lyrics without being, you know, without being gangster rap, they were people you could take seriously about the way they approached music and lyrics. And that was, it was big for me. And I think for a lot of people to see hip hop in that light.
Yeah.
And beyond that, Fife was just awesome. I mean, a guy who's 5 feet tall, who was able to project this gigantism from his voice on a record. I mean, he was one of the greats, man. And 45 years old. It's a damn shame.
There is no one who could open a song like that dude. And to this day, I'm on a mic a lot. You're on a mic a lot, right? Yep. And you do mic checks, and I swear to God, 75% of the time, I do check 1-2. Next thing I'm doing, microphone check 1-2. What is this? The 5 foot brother with the rough neck business. Yeah. And it just lodges in your head.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe also because I'm a 5 foot brother with rough neck business.
Here's a funky introduction of how nice I am. I mean, just killer lines. He was just he's one of the best.
You know, we talked when David Bowie passed,
yep,
kind of the impact of just seeing like the outpouring of love and respect, mm-hmm, from all of these artists and people who had stories about the influence of his work on their lives. And I couldn't help feeling like a similar thing from a comedy standpoint with Gary Shandling, and like just the immediate outpouring from funny people all over the world,
yep,
with oftentimes really personal stories about what Gary Shandling meant to them. And I don't just mean like, hey, his work touched me in this way. Like, a lot of them had actual personal stories about like things that Gary had done for them as a human being.
Yep.
It was really, I thought, something to see. You know, I mean, you know, for a lot of us who just were like, well, I really enjoyed the Larry Sanders Show and I thought it was really inventive.
Yeah.
Or I liked, you know, It's Gary Shandling Show before that, or, you know, any of the other things that he did. Like, you always thought he was a genius and that show was really ahead of its time, but it was another thing I think that really sort of put it all into perspective, just the amount of respect. And when you think about Larry Sanders Show and just the people that passed through it, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable, the comic talent in that show.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame it took this, but the Larry Sanders Show, I remember seeing on a number of occasions and loving, but I wasn't like a dedicated watcher of it or anything like that. My family, I didn't have HBO growing up, so it's not like I could watch those things all the time. So I've been going back to it a little bit, and man, it's just so hilarious, and it's so well done and so ahead of its time, in like that sort of mockumentary style almost.
Yeah, it really was the first one to kind of do that form, and there's, you know, it's so influential on the style of comedy that we see today, you know.
Yeah, and the other thing I think, you know, to your point about the outpouring, I think, again, a shame someone has to die to get this treatment, but you go back and see how influential so many of the things he has done are and how little attention he got, and it's sad and frustrating that, like, here was a guy, and, you know, I've listened to some interviews with him. Mark Maron, as he is wont to do, posted his full WTF podcast with Gary
Shandling. It's excellent.
Shandling.
Excellent interview.
Yeah, it's excellent, and you really hear that this was a guy who was, I mean, he thought his impact should have been more felt than it was, and he was right, damn it. And again, you see that where, and this was something that I tweeted, I hate to reference my own tweets, no I don't, at the Kolsky, go check me out, but just the idea of, like, if you're someone who wasn't really engaged with this guy, didn't really know much about him, all you really need to know is look at the way comedians you respect respond to his passing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just see, I mean, I think especially in comedy, people think of him as and realize he was really a genius.
Yeah.
and a creative force on a level that few people can match, and, you know, whether it's because of quirks of timing or just whatever, he didn't, the broader culture, as it were, and since we had that discussion earlier, didn't really realize what we had in Gary Shandling, and that is a shame.
Yeah, it is. And you know what, I'm on the IMDb page of Larry Sanders Show right now, and you just look at, just take a look at the writing credits.
Yeah,
you know, and you,
I mean,
see
Judd
these
Apatow
names.
was back there.
You know, people who have written incredible TV shows. You look at the cast, you know, and you know, Jeffrey Tambor, Jeanine Garofalo, Scott, Jeremy Piven, Bob Odenkirk, and then, you know, Jon Stewart did 6 episodes, Joshua Malina, and then you look down at just the people who appeared on this show at some point. Some of them, you know, doing the celebrity thing as themselves, but also people who played characters. And it's just a who's who of really funny, talented, amazing people. And
Scott Thompson, I don't think you mentioned. I mean,
Bill Simmons did a podcast with David Duchovny this week.
Yeah, Duchovny.
That was recorded before Shandling passed, which I thought was amazing, where Duchovny just talked about, you know, how obsessed he was with the show. And, you know, he had a pretty famous sort of guest starring role that essentially developed because he just begged his agents to get him on the show.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, you know, that you don't see that all that much in Hollywood.
No, certainly not.
So yeah, shouts to Gary Shandling. And I'm really excited that they've been already working on a deal with HBO to get the show back on HBO. And, you know, is it, I don't think it's up yet, but I think eventually, right? That's
yes,
be
they
on
have
demand.
Announced they, it will be up and you'll be able to stream it and all that. So everyone will be able to watch it again. And I think that's good for everyone. And also, by the way, it's still incredibly funny. It has not lost its punch.
Yes.
And watching it, you really realize how genius it is. That's what I was going to say. I also just want to shout out one of my favorite movies that nobody cares about, which is called Hurley Burley. Stars Sean Penn, Robin Wright Penn at that time, and Kevin Spacey. Also features what's her face, Sookie Stackhouse. Why am I blanking on her real name?
Anna Paquin,
Gary Shandling, and Chaz Palminteri. Yeah. Oh, and Meg Ryan in one of her great small character turns of acting. It is a whirlwind of over-talking, but I quite enjoy it, and Gary Shandling is wonderful in it.
Yeah, I'm going to miss that, dude.
Yep.
All right, let's should we jump into Batman versus Superman?
Yeah, I just love the idea that you insisted on talking about a movie that you have not seen and sounds like probably won't see.
Yeah,
so let's do it.
Well, are you planning to see it?
100% yes.
100%. So are you? So
not
you're
because
excited
I.
About it.
Well, no. Yes and no. Here's my take. I have an interesting feel about superhero movies. I love when they're great. You know, when the Avengers happens, I feel really happy. It's a great time out. But I also have no attachment to comics. You know, like, I didn't grow up as a comics kid, so I'm not ready to fly into a murderous rage over bad storyline decisions. And I'm all about expectation management at the movies in general. And so when a superhero movie is a spectacle of action and poor plot design, I usually leave feeling okay about it. So I feel like the odds of me going into this movie and leaving in a huff, really upset or mad that I spent the $15, I feel like the odds of that are very small. Chances are, at the end, I'll be like, all right, that was okay. I enjoyed watching stuff explode. Ben Affleck wasn't a bad Batman, and I'll live with it. That's kind of my expectation of it.
Well, and I'm in a place more of like superhero fatigue.
Sure.
Where I'm not anti superhero movie, and I do enjoy a really good one. The Batman ones that Christopher Nolan did, I thought were excellent.
They're no original Batman, but they are good.
Yeah, you know, like, I'll get down with another superhero movie,
mm-hmm.
but it needs to be good. And the reason that I resent this one so much, and so many of them now, is that they're just crass brand extensions at this point. Like, they're all so unnecessary. And you see that, you know, if you've seen any remotely seen any trailers for this movie, it looks so grim and terrible, and it's so obvious that it's just, we're just here because we've got to make an Avengers somehow.
Well, you can blame your buddy Christopher Nolan for it being that dark.
Right, but rather than hire someone with the expertise of Christopher Nolan who can make something dark and visually compelling, they've hired Zack Snyder, who, if you don't know, Zack Snyder directed The 300.
Which is, the one good thing he ever did was The 300, and even that was a pretty
not
low
very
bar.
Good, right. And then he did the last terrible Superman movie.
Although, you know, I actually didn't think that was so terrible. I will say, I think the worst part of that was Zack Snyder. I don't think Henry Cavill is such a bad Superman. I don't mind a Superman origin story. I think Michael Shannon was amazing in that first Superman. It's just, it's so overly.
I don't want to see anyone's origin story anymore. I'm done with the origin story.
But
so
it's a caricature. The problem with Zack Snyder is it's a caricature of a dark superhero movie.
Yeah.
And yes, I expect this one to be similar in that respect. But again, I can get through that. Just, you know, with the approach of like, okay, but this is all very silly.
I guess, but it's like, what's the fun in that? Like, why am I here so that you can set up four more franchise movies that are going to have bad scripts and...
No, you're right. It should be better.
You know, massive special effects staging. It's so, like, it just feels so joyless, and I kind of don't understand how anyone can get excited about it.
Well,
you know,
how
it's
about
interesting
this?
To me, like, people...
Well,
go ahead.
Okay.
How about this?
I was just going to say, it's not. I don't see what you're describing as a superhero problem. I see it as a Hollywood problem.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, we're in the. Yes, we're getting these sort of poor facsimiles of Christopher Nolan's first couple of Batman movies.
Well, that even Christopher Nolan doesn't want to make anymore.
Correct,
you know what I mean?
Correct.
Yeah,
but
they're
that's
like $200 million monuments to Hollywood laziness.
As is every blockbuster, because Hollywood, for whatever reason, is scared of original ideas. And unless you have the clout and creativity of a Christopher Nolan, which is like three people in the world, you don't have the power to do creative things because Hollywood wants to do stuff that they, quote, know will succeed. And they still, after all this time and all these failures, they still haven't realized that it's impossible to know anything will succeed. And in fact, reduxing something that people liked 15 years ago or even 5 years ago is not a recipe for success at all. It's a recipe for bad repetition.
Yeah.
I
think there's a piece of this that you're leaving out, and it's that the foreign markets are so critical to the ultimate financial success of
you're
a
right.
movie now.
And a lot of these movies do well in that respect.
Right.
That's
and
a damn shame.
They know they have these intellectual properties that can translate globally.
Great IP.
Right. and so they're trying to exploit those, but we're kind of all the worse for it. I'm curious because.
Well, but here's the other thing: is it so crazy for me to be of the philosophy that if foreign markets are sucking up this swill, they would gladly swallow something that's better?
Well, you know, will they swallow up something that's unfamiliar? That's the question.
Well,
and
but
that's
at
the gamble
some point
that
they did, didn't they? When Batman Begins came out and this miserable dark superhero thing was kind of born in full, didn't foreign markets eat that up? I mean, when stuff is good, people like it. And that to me is the easiest connection to draw, and yet Hollywood will not connect those dots.
Right. And ultimately, isn't that why the Marvel movies have done better?
Yes, because they're better movies.
Yeah, and they hire better people to make them.
Exactly.
It doesn't seem that hard, right?
No, it does not.
So the other thing I'm sort of curious about, and this will tie into something that I saw the other day, is like what impact does the, just the general critical consensus that this movie's terrible have on your desire to see it at this point?
For me, very little. Because, again, there are movies that what's the name of that Cormac McCarthy script that Cormac McCarthy wrote that turned into a terrible movie because he can't actually write scripts?
The Road, are you talking about?
No, because that's a book. No, the movies made from his books have had some better results. The Counselor, was it? Is there a movie called The Counselor?
Yeah, I think there is. Didn't see it.
Sorry, I just have to look this up because otherwise it's going to drive me up a wall.
Well, can you tell me your point about it? Yeah,
The Counselor, okay. 2013. And here is the point. I did not see it either. The point is, people told me The Counselor was a garbled mess, and that kept me from seeing it. Because that's a movie that I would have gone to see for the plot and for some level of artistry, and because I wanted to see a good film. So reviews of movies like that might keep me away. Reviews of movies like Batman v Superman, I don't care. I don't care what someone viewing it with a pretentious eye thinks, and that is usually what happens with reviews of superhero movies and comedies. Someone views it pretentiously and doesn't like it, and while they might be totally right, it usually doesn't have a big effect on my enjoyment of it.
All right. Well, this brings up something to me I think that's interesting. I saw an ad for a movie I do want to see, which is the new Richard Linklater movie, Everybody Wants Some.
Oh, it got bad reviews?
No, actually it's getting good reviews. Oh. But the ad, focused on a couple, had some critical pull quotes in them, but they kind of flashed up really quickly. They weren't, you couldn't really even see who was saying them. And then they just went right to the Rotten Tomatoes score. Like,
oh,
right,
yeah,
there.
I heard that.
In the ad.
They actually say in the radio commercial, it's got a great score in Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if we are now coming to a place where, the crowdsourcing of movies is going to take over. Or that function of, the big movie critics, like, the Washington Post or the New York Times, or, Siskel and Ebert are gone. But
by the way, it is
that
getting,
guy from Rolling Stone, yeah.
It is getting a great score at Rotten Tomatoes. It's 97%, so.
I'm sure it's excellent. But yeah, I think you're going to see that. It's going to be, I think you're going to see more and more people touting the Rotten Tomatoes experience. And I think that's kind of where we're headed for criticism. In general, like, we're gonna essentially all be yelping these movies from now on.
I think we're yelping everything, aren't we? I mean, isn't that the world that we live in? Everything gets the Yelp treatment.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen ads for bad movies, right? Where they pull like Twitter quotes from people.
Sure.
Yeah, like that kind of stuff, and it's like.
By the way, also getting great reviews so far on Rotten Tomatoes, Midnight Special, a movie I'm very excited about.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
All right, it sounds like we're going to have some homework there to do.
Boy, I don't know. I got a big weekend. Old Kolsky's is going to see Batman versus Superman and eat dim sum brunch. I've got a big plan.
Oh, wow. That's I got some Final Four basketball, a fantasy draft. I'm going to just.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The Final Four is still happening.
Yeah, that's a thing. Oh, yeah. While we're here, and maybe let's go out on this, I wanted to bring up one shiny moment. Do you have reverence for one shining moment?
You reach for the... No.
No, okay.
But that's because I'm just not a, I'm just not
you're
an,
just
I've
a college
been a
basketball
college
hater.
Sports person.
Yes.
No, I mean I am now, yes, I am now a college basketball hater. Even when I was not a hater, it was so far secondary to me to the NBA that I wasn't a huge... I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not anti-One Shining Moment. Good times. Watch everybody hit big shit. There's so many signature plays historically in every tournament. It's fun to watch them compiled.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm not opposed, but it's not like every year I'm waiting for that and excited about it.
It's a great moment. And for me, it's one of the highlights of my year. Like, I will... I taped the whole terrible post-game show just to get One Shining Moment at the end.
And then do you save it on your DVR for a while? Just
a little
go back
bit,
and
yeah.
watch it?
Tournament's not over until I get one. Like, I love One Shining Moment. Now, I don't have any particular, like, yes, of course, the song is cheesy. That's part of that's part of the greatness of it. It's like they play this super cheesy song on the basketball highlights. So, you know, this year CBS and Turner have announced that there's going to be a new artist on the song. They haven't said who it is, by the way. Yeah. You know, the most popular version is by Luther Vandross.
That's what I was going to say. It's Luther Vandross, right?
Yeah, I prefer the original, which is even cheesier than the Luther Vandross version, personally. But,
oh, wow.
Yeah, but people like Luther. And like, of course, of course, the internet reacted, just revolted at the idea that anyone would... They've changed it four or five times. Jennifer Hudson took a turn. Teddy Pendergrass did it for a while.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, like, they've messed around with it before, but, like, people are like, why would you touch my One Shining Moment? And I'm so, like...
Okay, but...
Where are we at as a society where this is a thing that we're gonna get angry about? Like, maybe a new One Shining Moment will be good. Like, is that... Can we allow for that possibility?
Okay, but is that a fair question to ask? Why change it?
I think... Like I said, they've changed it tons of times before. Why not change it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I guess that's a fair question to ask back.
It's still going to be the same song. It's still going to be highlights. Are we so sure that the Vandross version is perfection that we couldn't possibly do any better?
Don't you dare disrespect Luther Vandross.
The song is terrible. I think we can all acknowledge that, right?
I can.
I just don't. I'm puzzled by America. I think people just wants to be angry and comment about stuff on social media. You know,
well, that's definitely
our boy Damon Bruce about blew a gasket on Twitter. You know, and it's these same people that are like, oh God, we have 68 teams now. The tournament's ruined. Like, come on. Like, we're missing the point on this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it's, we don't have to leave everything exactly as it is. It's okay. Well, the spirit of One Shining Moment is still there. Right?
I mean, I think where you really get at it is people just really desperately want to scream on social media.
Yeah.
You know, and anything, any excuse, people want to go all in on the idiotic social media whining. I think that really, unfortunately, is where we're at. People want to be heard, and mostly they have nasty things to say.
That, yes, if you run a radio station, it's almost certainly true.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one that is truly one of the things that we really do get an intimate look at. I think maybe even more so in sports radio is like, boy, it's two phenomenons. The first is no matter what you talk about, someone's angry, mm-hmm. and they will text and tweet and call and tell you, how dare you talk about this, while at the same time you're getting five texts and tweets and calls saying, thank God you talked about this.
Right, and you get the bias thing too, right? Because if you take a shot at someone's favorite team, it's because you hate that team.
Yes, they have a visceral reaction to that. And then the other
and
sort of other
that,
end of it is they, you know, people, I can't tell you how often someone comes hard at me over something I say, you're an idiot, screw you, with less friendly language. And then if I just engage them, about 80 to 90% of the time, though, I can turn it around within like a three-tweet conversation to where that person is like, yeah, cool, okay, my bad for screaming obscenities at you. And then we move on
with
our lives.
Because, of course, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Of course, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Exactly. So people really do just want to yell and... A good excuse, like disrespecting Luther Vandross, you know, I think we just have to expect this.
Well, on that note, you're an idiot. Screw you. Go to hell, and I'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, okay. Sounds good. Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.